report, thanks to the good work of the Adjutant General from Louisiana, the troops that have been called in, that the convention center is secure. One of the objectives that we had today was to move in and secure that convention center and make sure the good folks there got food and water. The caravans, the bus caravans, are continuing on, as is the airlift. The people of this part of the world have got to understand, and by the way, we just came from the 17th Street levee. A lot of folks are working hard to repair that levee. They've been working around the clock, 24 hours a day. People from the federal government, the state government, the local government are working to breach that, to fill that breach. The mayor has been telling me, not only by telephone, but here in person, how important it is that we get that breach filled and get that pump station up and running. And we went there to inspect progress being done, and the people of New Orleans have got to understand there's a lot of people working hard, and they're making good progress. You know, I'm going to fly out of here in a minute, but I want you to know that I'm not going to forget what I've seen. I understand the devastation requires more than one day's attention. It's going to require the attention of this country for a long period of time. This is one of the worst natural disasters we have faced with national consequences. And therefore, there will be a national response. And I look forward to continuing to work with the governor and the mayor and the members of the Senate and the House of Representatives to do our duty.
Talking about your airlifting people out of the danger zone. Well, if you have all these damn planes, why couldn't you drop food to them? Or is it the only thing that you really know how to drop is bombs? Then you talk about how there are people working 24 hours a day. It doesn't matter much if the whole damn city is flooded under. What are they doing outside of looting other innocent people? I'm talking about the police and stuff. And then you talk about how you're going to fly out in a minute. Yeah, you should be flown out. I think you should be flown out in is another thing. And then you have the nerve to try to wrap it up about how this incident brings out a national consequence. And there should be a national response. Well, that you and I agree about. The national response should be death to the capitalists and to the capitalist system. You know, it's not his slave time. You're listening to 103.3, 101.1, Santa Cruz, 106.7, Illinois, Uprising Radio, LUVER.com, The World, 107.5, North Carolina, RadioForAll.net, The Universe. Click into the slave web, go Slave Revolt Radio, Google, find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to blast into a Ruins of Empire segment, as it's clear that this empire, in every stretch of the word, is truly in ruins. All that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3, Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong. Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Wake the hell up. On the real. And see what the hell is truly going on. Because as the genocidal wind, or in this case, somewhat of a hurricane, is blowing. And what is taking place before and in the aftermath in New Orleans can't be explained away as some kind of damn natural disaster. The catastrophe wasn't a result from Hurricane Katrina. It was a result from, in reality, in this Ruins of Empire segment, Hurricane Sam. On every front, this natural quote-unquote disaster happened. And how it, in part, happened is something that always takes place in world history. You know, it was a hurricane. But we have a situation of what you do and don't do for the society that you live in. How they prepare, how you prepare, says a lot about your place in a particular society. And how the society you live in immediately responds also sums up your place within a society. So we're not going to mess around too much. Let's just get right into this Ruins of Empire piece on Hurricane Sam. You know, there was a documentary that was done in September of 2002 on New Orleans. Dealt with the hurricane issues and other things concerning the environment around New Orleans. The City in a Bowl documentary. And the host, Daniel Zeswein, talks to various people. And the first person he talks to is a scientist named Joe Shahada about what would happen in New Orleans in this September 2002 documentary if a Category 5 hurricane hit New Orleans.
On a recent evening, a scientist pulls up in the French Quarter. Joe Shahada takes a plastic rod out of his trunk, and he proceeds to show us what could happen the next time a hurricane hits New Orleans.
Okay, this is a tool that I have, a range rod. It'll show us how high the water would be if the city were hit with a Category 5 hurricane.
Which would mean what? How many
About 20 feet of water above the ground that we're standing on right now.
20?
20 feet. So I'll extend this up.
A Category 5 hurricane is the most powerful form on a scientific scale. Tejeda plants the rod on the sidewalk next to a 200-year-old building that's all wrought iron balconies and faded brick and wooden shutters. Every click marks another foot that the flood would rise up this building.
I can't believe you're still going.
Yeah, I know. Kind of shocking.
Until a couple months ago, Tejeda ran a prominent research center at Louisiana State University. They've developed the most detailed computer models that anybody's ever used to predict how hurricanes could affect this region. Studies suggest that there's roughly a 1 in 6 chance that a killer hurricane will strike New Orleans over the next 50 years. Tejeda's still extending his stick.
It's well above the second floor there, and it's just about to the rooftop.
It's hard to comprehend, really.
It is, really, to think that much water would occur in the city during this catastrophic storm.
Do you expect this kind of hurricane, of this kind of flooding, to hit New Orleans in our lifetime?
Well, I would say the probability is yes. In terms of past experience, we've had 3 storms that were near misses that could have done at least something close to this.
So basically, the part of New Orleans that most Americans and most people around the world think of as New Orleans would disappear underwater.
It would. That's right.
All right, damn it. Now look, this is a September 2002 documentary. And here he's talking about a Category 5. This happened to be a Category 4. So if it had been a 5, it would have been even worse than what we see going on. But this guy had been involved with this research center at Louisiana State University and outlining the upcoming catastrophe that would hit the particular region concerning a major hurricane. These fools in the administration, in the wheels of economic power, the petroleum industry, they all knew of this probability. This stuff wasn't in the dark. It's just that they don't have a regard for certain portions of the population. It's expendable. Hell, look, the population of Iraq is expendable for their particular economic goals and control over resources. What the hell makes anyone think in the real world, especially black folks in a town that's 67% black, that you're not expendable? This is all part and parcel of the way the empire works and how much disregard they have for our basic lives. Now, it's to be expected. And when I say this, this is not to expect these fools out there, because all they're doing is running a sham game. But there is no Jesse Jackson. Where's Jackson? Where he should be. He has his head up his Democratic behind. Where's Sharpton? Well, Sharpton has his head up his perm behind. Where's Farrakhan? Well, up his Quranic one. See, in the real world, it's not about them. This is about us. Because it's not them. It's not the Negroes like them who do the suffering. It's us. So it comes down to us to prepare for these types of situations. No reliance on the state. The state exasperates these types of issues. The state and reliance on the state sets you up for these types of disasters. These fools in the state knew of the probability, as Shahada said, 1 in 6 chance that this would happen within 50 years. 3 storms were near misses. I mean, this is not an accident. There were certain things that could have been done to protect the levees and shore up the levees, but because of capitalist greed, capitalists not willing to put in resources that would be necessary, i.e. them saying that if it happens, it happens, and we'll just go from there, and the human cost and misery, well, that's just all part and parcel. This is the way they operate. So the suffering that ends up going on and the masses of people who end up suffering is something to be expected when you are within a market capital society that does not put a premium on your life. You got this little jive tycoon nagging, you know, He has his head up his elected official behind. You know, this little mayor and stuff like that. Another coon. This is just a con game. He's up here screaming like he's all upset and stuff. But he depends on the same forces, the same social controlling forces, and the same forces that have driven people into poverty and into this abject situation where you are vulnerable to the state. See, this is all about communication and networking within our own selves and our own communities to realize and educating ourselves on these types of issues so that we don't become as vulnerable. This is just a microcosm of how vulnerable we are in general. The raggedy pigs come rummaging through the neighborhood all the time, crashing up and destroying people's lives. This is just the pig force on a larger scale. Now next, Daniel goes over with Walter Mastry in this September 2002 documentary about what may happen concerning the area around Jefferson Parish. Let's check this out.
Just across the Mississippi River, Walter Mastry is struggling to help New Orleans prepare. Mastry's the czar of public emergencies in Jefferson Parish. That's the county that sprawls across a third of the metropolitan area. He points to a map of the region on the wall of his command post.
A couple of days ago, we actually had an exercise where we brought a fictitious Category 5 hurricane into the metropolitan area.
The map is covered with arrows and swirls and erasable marker. They show how the fictitious hurricane crossed Key West and then smacked into New Orleans. When the computer model showed Mastry what would happen next, he wrote big letters on the map, all in capitals.
KYAGB. Kiss your ass goodbye. Because anybody who was here as that storm came across was gone. It was body bag time. And we think 40,000 people could lose their lives in the metropolitan area.
And some scientists say that figure is conservative. People have known for centuries that New Orleans is a risky spot. The biggest river in North America wraps around it, and most of the land is below sea level. But researchers say they've been learning just how grave the problem is only in the last few years. And they say the city and the nation aren't prepared to handle it. To begin to understand why, we clamber up the levees along the Mississippi River.
There is no place in the world that has a levee system as extensive as this one. It's a monster system.
Our guide is Oliver Houck. He runs the environment program at Tulane University Law School. The U.S. Army built this monster system we're standing on. Since the late 1800s, the Army Corps of Engineers has built more than 2,000 miles of high grassy embankments along the Mississippi and its branches.
This levee system is to levees around the world the way the Great Wall of China is to walls around the world. I mean, there are other walls, and then there's the wall. And there are other levee systems, but this is the levee system.
The Army built it because storms over the Mississippi used to cause massive floods. Back in the 1920s, the river gushed over its banks and killed thousands of people and forced a million to abandon their homes.
It was always thought that the big threat of flooding in New Orleans was from the river. And it was, because it flooded regularly. And so we beat flooding by taming the river. The irony of history's been that we've, like one of those old citadels in the adventure story, defended ourselves against the enemy that we knew, which was the river. But to the rear and to the flank was this other threat that we're only beginning now to appreciate. And it may be too late to prevent.
The first warning shot came in 1969.
The remnants of killer Hurricane Camille continue to spread dust and destruction today, triggering flash floods and...
Hurricane Camille shook the country. It was one of those rare Category 5 storms. And here's the problem. When the government built the levees to protect New Orleans, they designed them to hold off much smaller storms. Government officials didn't expect that such a massive hurricane could hit the city in our lifetime. Or in our grandchildren's lifetimes.
A country's chief hurricane expert declared today that Hurricane Camille was the greatest storm of any kind ever to hit the nation.
Camille missed New Orleans, but only by 100 miles, which suggested that maybe government officials had been short-sighted. Then another Category 5 storm hit the country in the early 1990s. Remember Hurricane Andrew? Now officials in Louisiana started to worry more about New Orleans. And they got another warning just a few years ago.
Forecasters think George could strike New Orleans with 115-mile-an-hour winds. Thousands packed up and moved out, fogging evacuation routes.
And that taught everybody a troubling lesson. Joe Cejeda, the scientist with a big stick, drives me through the city to explain.
Well, Hurricane George, or George A, was one for which the track had the potential of flooding the city. So the people were given a mandatory evacuation order to evacuate the city.
And government officials had made elaborate plans so the population could evacuate smoothly. We keep passing blue street signs marked hurricane evacuation routes. The government had organized fleets of buses to rescue tens of thousands of people who didn't have cars. At the last minute, Hurricane George faded to a weaker storm and it veered away, which was lucky because the evacuation was a fiasco.
What happened to the people that did evacuate is that they got into massive traffic jams, and many of them spent the worst part of the hurricane either on the highway, stopped, or had pulled off to the side of the road.
Now, supposing the hurricane had really walloped New Orleans, there were all these thousands and thousands of people in their cars trapped on the road. What would happen to them?
Many of our evacuation routes are subject to flooding. And they would be washed away, and there would be really no way for the help, that is emergency services people, to get to them to help them.
All right, so once again, you know, the way the corporate media works and all of that apparatus, they don't really give you kind of a historical background. They may get upset because, you know, they may be getting cold or seeing the blatant hypocrisy of the state and its full throttle. So it kind of shakes them off of some of their particular illusions. That's some of them. Of course, you got the classic right wingers who are going to stay the course regardless. But the state has gotten all types of warning shots, as they mentioned in this 2002 documentary, 1969, Hurricane Camille. And then you had, in the 1990s, Hurricane Andrews. And then just a few years ago, George hit. And all this talk about how black people and other people should have evacuated, well, see, what they don't mention, as the documentary goes into, is that their whole route of evacuation has been a sham. Now, this is on top of the fact that the median income for black people in New Orleans is $11,000. The median income for whites is $30,000. 38% of the people in New Orleans live in abject poverty. 67% of the population is black. So you have a lot of disposable people under the guidelines of the state machine apparatus. Now, you put that on top of the fact that the way the state and the city had ran their particular evacuation program, it turned out to be just a fiasco and a fraud in the minds of people, and they saw how vulnerable they were, and if they had been had a major disaster actually hit during George and there had been a massive flooding, many of these people realized that they would have been flooded and drowned in their particular cars. So they lost confidence in the state, which is correct, but you have to take it beyond that. You just can't lose confidence in the state. You have to realize that your life is in your and other people's life's hands. And you can't depend on these forces that really don't have any regard. It's clear. Here the state sees that its evacuation program was a sham. A few years ago, we're not talking in the 1920s, that it was a disaster. It didn't work. And luckily, George hadn't smashed in like it possibly could have. So do they go about to resurrect the problem? Nah. You got FEMA and all of these things, which really aren't set up to save people in the first place, and they were have other motives in it and all stuck in. But the aspect of so-called helping in disaster relief, even those are cut by Boy George and company. You know, under the name of fighting their war on terrorism, which is just a war on the world. So this shows you how decrepit what the state is, and how much contempt that they have for the basic life of many people within this population. They're the bandits. All of this rhetoric about who's a looter and all of that, these people are the looters. They're the plungers. They're the ones who put certain forms of economic property, fossil fuel, et cetera, above human life. And they do what they have to do to loot people from their basic survivability mechanisms for these exercises. Now Daniel goes into the natural buffer that is a buffer from the hurricane, but how it's being and how it was being eroded unnaturally, naturally by capitalist exploitation standards, but unnaturally in a way that a halfway civil society that knows it has to live in a form of sustainability and cooperation with the planet and its resources operates. In other words, the destruction of New Orleans wetland is what we're about to go into next.
Scientists worry more about hurricanes every single year. There's always been a huge natural buffer that helps protect New Orleans from storms. There are miles of wetland between here and the Gulf of Mexico. They slow hurricanes down as they blow in from the sea. But that buffer is disappearing. Every year, a chunk of wetland the size of Manhattan crumbles and turns into open water.
So the hurricane can move closer to the city before it starts to decrease its intensity. So in effect, the city is moving closer to the Gulf as each year goes by.
And he says it's partly because of those levees along the Mississippi River. It turns out that when the government stopped the river from flooding, it prevented the wetlands from getting the regular doses of flood water and mud that they need to survive. So hey, the studies show that if the wetlands keep vanishing over the next few decades, then you won't need a giant storm to devastate New Orleans. A much smaller hurricane could do the job. That's why Walter Maestri and his colleagues are getting ready at the Emergency Command Center in Jefferson Parish. He says if the hurricane comes, they'll seal themselves inside.
This is the communication center here. At every station, we've got fire, we've got emergency medical, we've got public works, National Guard. Because
Maestri says, picture what happens if a huge storm strikes just to the east of the city.
The hurricane is spinning counterclockwise. It's now got a wall of water in front of it some 30, 40 feet high. As it approaches the levees that surround the city, it tops those levees. The water comes over the top, and first, the communities on the west side of the Mississippi River go under. Now, Lake Pontchartrain, which is on the eastern side of the community, that water from Lake Pontchartrain is now pushed onto that population, which has been fleeing from the western side, and everybody's caught in the middle. The bowl now completely fills, and we've now got the entire community underwater, some 20, 30 feet. Underwater.
All right, once again, this exposes a priority situation. All of this research was done, this understanding was done. You have every year, as they mentioned, wetlands the size of Manhattan disappearing. Now, what does this sound like? This sounds like how the ice caps are melting and how in Antarctic, large chunks of ice the size of Manhattan and Rhode Island come crashing into the sea and stuff, and the impact that that is having on the currents, on the sustainability for humans and other species on this particular globe. But the capitalists don't have that as a priority. Their priority is profit. It's profit over everything. They're not operating in a sustainable way. The whole fact that they're locked into this petroleum industry is part and parcel of proof of that. This is just madness going on. Now, at the same time, part of the problem with the wetlands is that the way these petrochemical corporations have slaughtered and dug up the wetlands, put it in their pipelines and stuff. So they degraded massively the wetlands themselves directly. And then for their particular purposes, the way that they put in the levees, but is not in coordination with a healthy type of way of sustainability. It's just a quick fix. But who becomes the victims of it? I mean the short-term victims. If these capitalists keep pushing the thing the way that they're heading, everything's on the brink of destruction. But in the immediate aftermath, it's clear who pays the heaviest price. The people that they don't mind paying the heaviest price. The disposable. So here you have a situation where the wetlands are being destroyed every year, every day they're melting away, so on and so forth. This intensifies the hurricane production. And then you have a situation where the capitalists are polluting the earth, and this intensifies the strength of the hurricanes. It doesn't mean there's going to be more hurricanes, but it intensifies the hurricanes. And then the hurricanes hit, things flood out, like into the Mississippi and all of that. And as I've mentioned many times before on some of the environmental slave shows, you have a 7,500 foot, it's probably bigger now after all this nonsense. It's a dead zone in the Mississippi, caused in part by the whole Cancer Alley, petroleum, plastic companies that are completely deregulated, that dump their toxic soup into the Mississippi, and then the way that the fertilizer industry is locked within the petroleum industry, so they use petroleum to make a lot of the fertilizer. The fertilizer runs off, the residue of the fertilizer runs off, and one of the main arteries in that part of the country, from all these different regions throughout that area, is the Mississippi. This has created a dead zone where no living animal can exist inside there. So fish that get caught up in this dead zone, and it's been growing and growing every year, perish and stuff. In other words, they're collapsing the infrastructure of the Mississippi. But now, this same toxic soup is all over the place. Next, Walter Mastry talks about how a high-impact Hurricane 5 could cost more lives than a terrorist attack. But in reality, they're one and the same. Hurricane Sam, 9/11, it's the same people.
One of the things that's frustrating now, and for all of us in my business, is that if that Category 5 hurricane comes to New Orleans, 50,000 people could lose their lives. Now, that is significantly larger than any estimates that we would have of individuals who might lose their lives from a terrorist attack. When you start to do that kind of calculus, and it's horrendous that you have to do that kind of calculus, it appears to those of us in emergency management that the risk is much more real and much more significant when you talk about hurricanes. I don't know that anybody, though, psychologically has come to grips with that the French Quarter of New Orleans could be gone.
Now, their response, you know, we talked about 50,000 could lose their lives in his 2002 documentary. And he talked about, you know, how the French Quarter could be gone, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this whole thing could have been much worse. This was a Category 4. It could have been incredibly worse. The reason why many people are dying is because of the state's lackadaisical attitude. So had it been a Category 5, the 50,000 type prediction could have actually been substantially more than this because of their non-caring response on a disposable population. This is a Rwanda-like type of response. This is the casual type of response that they're having towards their friends in the cartoon government who, you know, the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on, the ones that are carrying out the genocidal slaughter of black people in the Western Darfur region. These people are just basically looting capitalist bandits that have no real regard for certain portions of the planet's life. From Iraq to New Orleans. This is a historical and current thing. This is nothing new. But one must drop all illusions about what's going on. In that Loma Prieta earthquake way back in 89, when most people were like coming home from school, you know, grade school and stuff, and about to watch the San Francisco Giants get whipped up by the Oakland A's, and the quake hits, and the quake causes the Cypress Freeway to collapse. The Cypress Freeway ran through West Oakland, crashing right through the neighborhood, toxically polluting the neighborhood, intensifying the asthma rate in the neighborhood. But of course, this, you know, is a neighborhood that is disposable. The lives are disposable, right? Just like in New Orleans, just like in Darfur, just like in portions of Florida, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a situation where, but the Cypress collapsed. The top shelf collapsed on the bottom shelf. And you had a number of brothers who ran out and then started pulling people out of their cars and trying to save the ones that weren't smashed to death. Now, these people, they didn't know. Many of these people had nothing to do at all with the community. They were just driving through the community as this little, you know, Cypress Expressway was, like many black neighborhoods, was run through. What happens? The little raggedy Oakland pigs come out and start screaming, "Niggas, get back in your house." So here, black people come out to save many people who don't look anything like them in the name of just humanity, in the name of common goodness. And they're doing it in an area and on a very unstable area because of how the earthquake just hit. So they're risking their own lives to save people that they don't know on a contraption that was built and helped destroy some of the financial district in West Oakland. That has a lot of historical history to it. They look past that, and how do the pigs respond? In the same way that they respond in New Orleans, in the same way they respond all over the world. Now look, this stuff can't be tolerated. The response to some pig running up to you, talking about nigga getting a house and all of that, they're saying your life is not worth anything. That can't be tolerated. And those who do that type of stuff, they just gotta go. Enough of this playing around type stuff. I mean, this is the real world. Now here, this is how certain branches of the nihilistic capitalists plant certain seeds for their own collapse and undermine the stability of their own empire that they operate in. But they are so caught in the profit, immediate profit, next semester profit, full-scale, no-holds-bar, capitalist type of mode of thinking that it's beyond them, for most of them, to even try to step back and try to put capitalism in somewhat of a model where it is not so blindly reckless. Now here is Millings. He's this little capitalist banker. He has a little like $7 billion, you know, banking thing going on in New Orleans. And he's talking to an environmentalist who is basically talking about saving the wetlands. And the environmentalist's main function or focus is on the birds and the fish and so on and so forth. Now, of course, Millings is not really interested in all of that type of talk because those items are more or less disposable to him unless he happened to have investment into the fishery business. Then it would have meant something. But then he realizes that the wetland and the corridor of the wetland is where many of the industry that he has making investments in. So, of course, it takes on another tone, but I'll let him explain it from here.
Finally, I looked up at him in the middle of it and said, my friend, the heck with the birds and the fishes. I think it jolted him a little bit, and I said, this is not about the birds and the bees. This is about whether or not the economic prosperity of Louisiana can continue.
And Milling says, here's what hit him. Banks like his have invested billions of dollars in businesses across this region. He points to the dots sprinkled across the map. He says, you'll find a Whitney National Bank in the heart of every one of those towns.
Well, this whole area is composed of shipbuilding yards, fabrication yards, gas processing plants, chemical installations. Those towns that are located up and down the various bayous and rivers form the cornerstone of wealth throughout South Louisiana.
And on this map, these towns are surrounded by splotches of red and pink, which signifies that the wetlands around them are vanishing. Milling says the more he looked at the map, the more he realized that if the wetlands wash away, his bank's investments could wash away. The state's whole economy could be crippled.
It has everything to do with whether or not Louisiana, as we know it, will survive in the future.
So now this powerful banker is helping to lead a campaign to save the wetlands. King Milling's barnstorming around the state. He's preaching to power brokers who think twice about letting an environmentalist through their doors. He's giving speeches to the Chamber of Commerce and the top 50 businessmen's club. He's lobbying fellow bankers and lawyers. And Milling keeps telling them, if you still don't understand why the wetlands are so crucial, please drive to a spot on the Louisiana coast. Talk to a man named Ted Salgu.
This little dot on a map, this small place in Cajun, southeastern Louisiana, on the Gulf of Mexico, provides this country with somewhere between 16 to 18% of its entire hydrocarbon supply, oil and gas. No other place in this country has played such a great role to this nation's oil and gas supply.
There are thousands of offshore drilling rigs out in the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of the oil and gas they produce, plus oil from the Middle East, gets to the mainland through this port. Then the industry distributes that fuel through pipelines, which are buried under the wetlands all along this coast. And here's the problem. When the energy companies buried those pipelines deep in the soil, they assumed it would keep them safe. But now the land around them is crumbling. At the moment, we're standing on the shoulder of the highway that leads into the port. The telephone poles beside us are sinking in water. There are little waves lapping near our shoes.
20 years ago, this was dry land. You could go out 500-600 feet out here and not wet your shoes. Now it's basically a lake. It's exactly what it is. In 2 weeks from now, you'll have shrimpers. The inshore season opens, and there will be vessels right up against this roadway catching shrimp. We are seeing thousands upon thousands of acres of land just disappear.
So now the pipes that used to be deep in the ground are getting exposed in open water. In fact, there was a nasty oil spill earlier this year. State officials say a boat cut right through one of British Petroleum's lines. Valgu says the company has reburied 7 miles of pipeline right near where we're standing, and it cost them millions of dollars. So consider the fact that there are 20,000 miles of pipelines under this crumbling coast.
But we're talking, you know, billions of dollars to come in repair and hopefully fix these things before we have a major disaster where we have pipeline ruptures and we have huge oil spills as a result of the coastal land loss.
Now remember, this is a 2002 documentary. So all of this type of stuff about being shocked and Boy George talking about no one could have predicted that the levees would break and all of that type of rhetoric, when all of this type of stuff had been thoroughly documented, researched and stuff like before. It was just that Boy George's capitalist masters didn't want to invest, even though their own particular type of financial empire is rested on those stretches of land. But, you know, they'll just jack up the price and do some smoke and mirror tricks and, you know, let a bunch of people die. It's not a priority to them. Now, at the same time, you have a situation where here this clown, Millings, suddenly he sees that his economic stability is tied into the particular wetlands. This is the only thing that motivates him. Well, see, right there, that shows you how warped of a human being, or something like a human being, that he is. Because he has no real connection to the land and the stability of the land and the environment and how there needs to be a kind of coexistence. All of that to him is rhetoric. But so then he's trying to convince other people like him. But, you know, you have other people within the government and so on and so forth who may have other priorities like war on terrorism or other things that doesn't have the type of urgency that he found himself in. So what you end up having is a situation where the city funds, you know, for the Army Corps of Engineers that were involved in a lot of this Levy stuff and work on the wetlands and stuff and restorations of the wetlands in New Orleans, well, that money got evaporated and defunded in 2003 by Boy George. This was a 10-year project and, of course, thrown into things like Iraq. So the thing is, the capitalists, who many of whom are based in oil, they have so low regard and they are so used to gambling on the planet, gambling with the environment, gambling on resources, so on and so forth, that they put their energy into thrusting into controlling other regions and resources throughout the planet, like Iraq. Intentionally, this is not an accident, they intentionally neglect what they had helped create in New Orleans, and kaboom, their gamble rings out snake eyes, and this is what you get. Now you have a situation where when they have, as they realize, 20,000 miles of pipe, you know, in these wetlands, under the wetlands, and now they're being exposed because the wetlands are disappearing and now the pipes are being, you know, exposed above surface and stuff, they're not willing to pay for this. They're not willing to pay for the investment that they put in to these types of energy systems. So they want a bailout. So they go through all of this rigmarole stuff for some kind of bailout. And when they go through all of this, meanwhile, the hourglass is ringing. It's last bit of sand. And what you end up having is this disaster. But none of the spotlight, like it should be, is on them. Yeah, they'll complain about Boy George not coming, you know, and doing enough in time and all of that. But the economic market instability and how it's based in instability and how it's recklessly based in a destructive mold, how it's basically putting people on the planet on a time bomb, Iraq, New Orleans, wherever, is what needs to come into focus, and how one, especially black people, can't have any illusion about what these profiteers and how these profiteers regulate and outline their motives. Now, next we have a situation where, as I said, it would cost, where they decided it would cost tens of billions of dollars to, in 2002, to rebury these pipes and so on and so forth. Of course, they didn't want to do it. They wanted some kind of bailout, so on and so forth. And that's not even going into making it sustainable. And that's not even bringing in the question of phasing out humanity from this dead energy system and moving into living energy systems. You know, wind power, solar power, things like that. It's not a coincidence that it's called fossil fuel when it's a dead energy system. It's fossil fuel. But now, in typical capitalist fashion, the capitalist approach towards the wetland problem is not as a human, as I mentioned before, or species sustainability issue, but just basically a capitalist economic one.
On a recent morning, Mulvaney and Governor Spratt huddled in the state capitol.
Let's look at the focus group findings.
They've hired a consultant to hammer out a strategy.
The first objective of the campaign is the designing of the message itself, the themes that define the problem and the impact of the erosion of Louisiana's wetlands. Any thoughts on that?
The environmental side is very important, but our issue here is fundamentally economics. I mean,
business leaders like Milling don't know much wetland science, but they do know the power of marketing. Their consultants, Val Marmillion, looks very Los Angeles, buzz cut, bright blue glasses. He knows it's going to be tough to get money from Congress for wetlands when everyone's worried about the economy and terrorism. So he's been test marketing patriotic brand names for the ad campaign.
America's Wetland was the outright choice in the Pennsylvania focus group. All said that if this is of national importance, we've got to move away from branding it the Louisiana this, that, or something else. We have got to make this America's issue, not Louisiana's. And so the brand has got to talk about how Louisiana benefits the nation in economic terms and others. We're going to get to those
after the meeting. I sit down with Marmillion. The marketing meeting has sounded almost like they're selling soap for cereal. Some people might wonder, is this a seemly way to educate the public about vanishing wetlands?
Yeah, I think it's an honest way. We are in a media age that people decry oftentimes, but we are in competition with a lot of other stories out there. And you use the mechanisms of the day to tell your story.
But these political and business leaders don't have any illusions. They're going to face lots of hurdles when they get to Congress. For instance, Louisiana's corrupt political past could haunt them.
That is correct. We have a very checkered history.
Jack Caldwell runs the state's Department of Natural Resources. He just took part in the marketing session. Now he's strolling under magnolias on the Capitol grounds. Caldwell says he realizes that some members of Congress might hesitate to send money to a state where everybody from governors to sheriffs have gone on trial.
For example, on the insurance commissioner, you're not going to believe this. The last three in a row have been convicted.
So once again, you have a situation where, how do these capitalists look at this situation? As a marketing strategy. And then, of course, they think that that's honest, or at least they say it. But in the real world, of course, it's not an honest way of dealing with it, because a marketing strategy is just basically trying to sell you a particular illusion and image. It's not about trying to tell you the truth, because if one was truly trying to search for the truth about the wetland problem, one would have to bring into focus the whole social, economic, market, capital order. The machine that crushes wetlands. The machine that crushes human lives. The machine that crushes a sustainable type of coexistence on the planet. This is not what these heathens are all about. Now, and on top of that, these are the same corporations that are polluting the Mississippi. Now, what's their market strategy about that? To ignore it? To put out propaganda that is not true? I mean, so, of course, these are marketeers. They're going to look at these issues as being market-based problems. Not problems of bringing about true education to the masses, because that's on us. It's not on them. It's not on these little shuck and jive politicians, these governors that are calling shoot to kill orders and all of that type of stuff. They're out there to preserve the existing order. And on this looting stuff, like I mentioned about the governor and the shoot to kill, here you have this cat admitting that from the governor to the sheriff, the last three insurance operatives were convicted. These are the real looters. They're looting everything under the sun. These petroleum industries with their pipes, they're running right into your soul and sucking out or putting in all types of toxins and stuff. You have areas like Convent, Louisiana, this neighborhood that's about 98% black. This area was having a situation a few years back where some of the highest pollution rates that people were bringing in anywhere in the country were being recorded, where pounds and pounds of pollution people were breathing in per year. Pounds of pollution. You know, one of these cancer alleys. Of pollution people were breathing in per year. Pounds of pollution. You know, one of these cancer alley type regions and stuff. So, how do these guys deal with it? In a market strategy type of way. And as one of the capitalist bandits admitted, that for them, it's an economic issue. Well, these are economic terrorists. Now here we have Mr. Save the Wetland, you know, Millings again, choking up for the petro industry. You know, Millions, of course, is this banker who has investment, you know, in the bankers and other of these polluting industries all around the corridor. And here's how, when it was put to him about, you know, since the petrochemical corporations, the petroleum corporations were the ones who devastated and dug up and chopped up the wetlands and laid their pipes in ways that were not within harmony to the particular region, what about them paying their share at the very least? Well, of course, Mr. Save the Wetlands Millings' response is,
I remember anyone at that time suggesting that this country should stop these activities and not have that petroleum product. Everybody was doing what they thought was the right thing at the right time.
Oliver Houck says, come on, that's not why they're tiptoeing around the energy industry.
Oil and gas is the dominant source of revenue in this state. It's like coal in Wyoming. It's like sugar in South Florida. It wags the dog. And for that reason, it would take an extremely bold public official in South Louisiana to take any position that would be to the disfavor of the oil and gas industry. And one thing that will clearly be to its disfavor is to have to pay part of the bill for the cleanup.
An energy industry spokesman says they'll consider helping pay for the wetlands projects if and when they see a firm plan. But the nation can debate all that in the future. First, business leaders like King Milling need to convince you and Congress that a national treasure is dying in their backyard, and that you have the power to save it. A lot of debates in this country have pit the economy against the environment. But back at his headquarters at the Whitney National Bank, Milling says he's learned a lesson. When it comes to Louisiana, at least, the environment is the economy.
And if it's allowed to fail, the economy will fail, and then we've lost everything.
The environment has always been everything for living species. That's what these capitalists don't understand. They think that they are truly the rulers of the universe. This is how sick they are. This is how out of touch they are. This is how arrogant they are. I mean, they walk around not even knowing or really contemplating the fact that they do breathe air, that it is a resource, a living resource that is essential to their existence. But their eyes are so green, they're so warped, that these types of reality is just unsustainable for them. This is how sick these clowns are. Now, when he's talking about a national treasure, for him, he's just basically talking about his little economic enterprise. He's not talking about the people, the history, what New Orleans is producing from a cultural heritage standpoint, jazz, so on and so forth. Nah, that, you know, he's talking about the dollars. And as you heard him, he was still pitching for the oil industry because these capitalists are tied together. You know, this banker doesn't want these petroleum industries to have to pay because this type of stuff takes out from a capitalist market system. It takes out some of the value of their investment into looking for more oil to, you know, suck out of the ground and stuff like that. That's not good investment, you know, for them. So he didn't want to see this type of market, the industry lose its value in the market. When I say value, I'm talking about on their particular terms, any more than they want to see the petroleum industry go obsolete. So what basically is the end result? The population in around that region is expendable. And that's how it just played out. And that's how you've seen it play out. Now next, we have a situation where here's Labash yapping about the New Orleans port being down and the cost to New Orleans, not the human cost. Now, what's interesting about this is that this guy is talking on one of the New Orleans TV shows, the news shows, on Friday, September 2nd. And basically, the concern about the port being down and now it being up and running helps put focus on where these guys' value system truly is. Check it out.
Remember, it serves 60% of the consumer spending public of America. You've got up the supply chain, you're going to have some serious economic consequences. Home Depot, Target, and all of those folks up in Chicago and St. Louis not getting their product or getting it on time or in a timely manner from the port of New Orleans. So several things are going to happen, obviously. Either the cargo will be delayed, that which can't, or it will be diverted to other ports at a much more costly, in a much more costly vein. Again, at the end of the day, the main thing we can do is continue to showcase the port of New Orleans. It's a heck of a thing to say on a day like today and yesterday, but to continue to showcase and let them know that the port is realistically and open tomorrow. The channel's fine. We've been with the pilots all day, and we will receive some 12 to 14 Navy ships, as I understand. And we've been on the phone since Tuesday night with Secretary Mineta.
Okay. Mr. LaBrosh, can you hold Mr. LaBrosh?
Damien of Marriott trying to line up other types of ships that will, you know, placate the needs of opening the port again.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. LaBrosh. We appreciate it.
Thank you. We're not going away.
But they need to go away. See, this is quite revealing. See, they just had this guy on this little show on Friday talking, yapping, and he's talking about, you know, the ports are back open and
There's going to be 12 to 14 Navy ships and all of this type of stuff. The channel's fine. And he said it within the context of Home Depot getting their products. And if their ports aren't open, it's going to get delayed or diverted to other ports. They're going to cost more and all of that. Well, if the ports are open, have been reopened, why isn't there food coming through the ports? People are dying. You just had situations where today it's been reported that people in stadiums have been dying, going to particular stadiums, Superdome, and finding no food after they've been told to come there. It's turned into just a mockery. But see, these guys' priority isn't there. All he's talking about is the same type of stuff that Millions was talking about, the banker. Profit. It's profit over people. This is right in the middle of the crisis. And he's talking about the ports being open for their particular type of marketing, merchandise, and all of that, and showcasing the ports and all of this type of stuff. Right in the middle of this issue, of this catastrophe happening, this just shows the utter contempt that they have. Now, to go on with the utter contempt for black lives that the majority of people have in this particular society, you know, the large majority of the people in the Superdome who have been stuck there finally today have had a bus come on September 2nd. And all types of crazy stuff has been going on at the Superdome. People have died, misled, water was cut off right in front of people's eyes, etc., etc. So you have a situation where people, you know, finally see the buses come to take them off. But then they find out that people who are staying at the Hyatt Hotel, in other words, economically more well off, to stay at the hotel, 700 of them were allowed to get in front of them. In other words, Negroes get in the back of the bus in traditional fashion, as this was reported live on live TV coverage in New Orleans.
Could move to the head of the evacuation line, much to the amazement of those who have been crammed in the stinking Superdome since Sunday. Howard, 22-year-old Howard Blue, told the Associated Press, quote, how does this work? They are clean, they are dry, they get out ahead of us? He tried, of course, to get in their line. The National Guard blocked him with other guardsmen, helped the well-dressed, according to the Associated Press, guests with their luggage. Now, the 700 have been trapped in the hotel next to the Superdome, but conditions were considerably cleaner, even though they didn't have running water, when the unsanitary crush inside the dome. The Hyatt was severely damaged, though, by the storm. As Dennis, you say there, every pane of glass on the riverside wall was blown out. Mayor Nagin also used the hotel, as we've been telling you, as a base, since it is across the street from City Hall, and there were reports that the hotel was cleared with priority to make room for police, firemen, and other officials. And just to finish off the story, National Guard Captain John Poehler called the decision to move the Hyatt people to the head of the line at the Superdome, quote, very poor.
That's very questionable, I think.
Yeah, and so the evacuation at the Superdome continues, but 700 guests from the Hyatt have been moved ahead of the line and will be getting out earlier than some of those other people who have stayed at the Superdome for several days since the storm first hit.
See, this is one of the advantages of checking these clowns out live while things are happening, because these types of stories come out that help highlight the contempt once again that they have for the basic lives and humanity for certain portions of the population. Here, basically, the more economically well off they were staying and paying at the hotel get preferential treatment. It's all color-coded, shown live on TV and stuff. I mean, it's just so blatant and stuff. So you can see why they would use terms in a sick way, like calling people refugees, because black people are refugees. They're treating black people like refugees in this country, as alien forces, disposable forces. This is not a coincidence. This is this utter contempt. And for those who are the poorest, you know, when Boy George passed that bankruptcy thing, that bill, it didn't allow the discretion of a judge to take into account why someone was bankrupt. And an amendment on a natural disaster causing bankruptcy, that was defeated. So if you go bankrupt because of a natural disaster, you lost your home and you don't have insurance because you're not you don't have enough money for the insurance, that's your ass. That's your ass. Because of what these clowns, these demons have passed. Just recently. See, once again, this is get in the back of the bus, or in certain cases, the coffin. This is utter contempt for the disposable people's lives. Now, if someone has that type of mentality towards you, then I would suggest that you would make their lives disposable, because your life is literally at stake. Now, you know, part of the reason why that I cover and critique some of these right-wing quacks, you know, on Fox and CNN, etc., is not for my health or anything. Part and parcel because of its embeddedness in the black experience and how these demons poison society with their toxic, divisive rhetoric for their class masters. With that in mind, here's Limbaugh.
The libs are able to get those same people to the polls to vote. On election day, apparently it wasn't important enough to evacuate them to save their lives. The hypocrisy is stunning. The non-black population was just as devastated, but apparently they were able to get out, and the black population wasn't able to get out. Maybe New Orleans has a half-decent mass transit system, and some of these people don't need cars. But no, Rush, that's your score. You're glossing over. They can't afford cars. Well, why is that? Why can't they afford them?
Once again, there it is, really quite plain, the utter contempt and how these guys work within the social machine order to poison people's minds and to get them to thinking as black people as subhuman and thereby disposable. This fool talking about, you know, why can't they afford cars? Well, I just mentioned how the median income for the black population in New Orleans is $11,000. And New Orleans has one of the lowest rate of people who own cars, not only because of economics, but also because of how the city is just situated. Now, I mentioned before and showed before how many people who did have access to cars didn't really have confidence in what was going on because of the farce that happened during Hurricane George. But see, Limbaugh is not about trying to put things into proper context. He's just a shuck and jive artist who's designed to poison one's mind. And this has an effect and infects the way people cooperate, look upon other human beings, deal with other human beings, and how they help keep the class line for the masses of people from consolidating. So this is his particular role and function. This is just not someone who just happened to drop out of the sky and just happens to have a certain personality that clicks with people, so they just let him ramble on. He has a certain purpose and function. As here, now, the slime ball plays out the law and order card. Law and order in New Orleans.
What would you do? Let me ask whoever's writing these editorials at the New York Times. You've got 3 days to set up a rescue operation system that saves everybody. You've got 3 days to eliminate all the crime and looting that, by the way, has been permitted to go on down there for I don't know how many decades. Because, you know, law and order has become a code phrase for racism. So you can't talk about law and order. You think this is a new thing with these people running around down there with guns? They're doing what they can do. And to somehow make all of this the fault of Washington, all of this the falls of the Bush administration. It's like nothing ever happened in this country before Bush became president. Like there was no crime. There wasn't any crime in New Orleans before Bush became president.
So once again, you see what this lowlife is doing. And how he plays his particular function out to get people off of the real issues. The real issues of sustainability. And how this market order is not sustainable. How it recklessly disregards certain portions of the population and the world population's lives. It's humanity. It means nothing to them. That's how the order works. That's how the machine grinds people out. And he's part of that machine. Here this fool has the nerve to talk about law and order being a code phrase, which it is. Nixon and them have admitted it. When Nixon and them were first starting to use it and coming up with their particular philosophy and Southern strategy type techniques, him and Haldeman outlined how they were trying to make everything negative look like it was a result of the young, the poor, and the black. The young, which were the hippies at the time, the poor, for this being poor, and of course that cross-pollinated with this being black. So just being black was orchestrated as being part of an alien society. And under this law and order construct of them trying to act like things during the 60s and 70s were getting out of control, they needed quote-unquote law and order as a stability mechanism. Of course, that meant pulverizing portions of the population and using various pretexts, war on drugs, war on crime, war on guns, as a means to do it, while yelling out law and order as a symbol of stability. It is what it is. Haldeman and them said it and admitted it as much. So the crime and looting that Limbaugh talks about is just some cats trying to get something to eat or whatever. The state has no credibility. The state is the looter. The state is the looter and the plunderer of the planet, of the land and the resources. It was the state that created and put this situation in its intensified Hurricane Sam mode. But of course, that's Limbaugh's role. Now here's a plea from a real sister, a sister named Diamond, with roots in New Orleans, from herself and her family, as told to her by her mom, who's still down there, about what's really going on in this day and time.
My mother, basically, I'm also a person born and raised in the city of New Orleans, been out here for about 18 years. I talked to my mother first last evening, and when I talked to her, she told me I needed to talk to every radio station that I possibly could, because she was living in the Third Ward, downtown New Orleans, and coming out, she has seen bodies floating in water. She's seen, the main thing she told me to do when I called the radio station, she said to let them know, as of day one after that hurricane, the soldiers that were there and the police officers that were supposed to be policing the situation, these are people who came out of a flooded situation, they had lost their families, their homes. They were greeted like they were prisoners from the first day. These people
right.
were treated like prisoners. They weren't, these people, these soldiers and police officers were not standing with open arms giving them direction. Go here, the Red Cross is up the street, or FEMA is at the other direction. They didn't have no direction. Everywhere that they listened on the radio, they were saying, just get out of New Orleans. How can you tell people to just get out of New Orleans? There's a million ways to get out of New
right.
Orleans. But you in the center of the city with water. My mother was caught in a four-story building, and water is constantly rising, and they're hearing that there ain't nothing going to be done. And coming out of this, they had no direction. My mother said that people who have family members, you cannot depend on the administration to help your families. She been in the Superdome. She said it is the equivalent of a concentration camp. My mother said that when she went into the Superdome, the water was still running. She watched them cut the water off. Okay? She watched them cut the water off. she said, as she walked from the, as she went from the people helped pull her. I want to say something about, there are a lot of heroes down there in New Orleans helping people. One of the things that I saw when watching the news on the first day afterwards, they immediately started showing people looting and stealing. These are people who knew that they need, they was not prepared. The people in New Orleans was not aware of the danger that they were in. These are people who've been, the majority of the people living in New Orleans have been living below the poverty line since day one. These people, there's not a lot for these people to do to begin with in New Orleans. I'm born and raised there. I know what the situation is like. They are not, these people have been struggling from day one, and they come out of this situation, no help, no flags with Red Cross like it was for the tsunami victims. The situation where Bush's brother is governor down in Florida, when they had their situation, the day after the situation, they can look, you can look in up into the air and see Red Cross flags. You know that you got a sense of direction. You know that you got a point that you're moving in a direction where there's help. These people have nothing.
Right.
And these soldiers from the first day treated them like they were prisoners.
Right.
The world needs to know this. The world is these people who this administration have the war tools over their eyes, and they saying that they can't do this, they can't do that. That woman asked Bush, why aren't you dropping, since you can't get into the city, why are you not dropping food?
I've wondered about that.
And I know why isn't he going to New Orleans?
I feel personally that these people are being annihilated.
Right.
It is a natural catastrophe. It's a natural situation that has taken place, but the administration is taking advantage of it.
Thank you.
I'm telling you, the world needs to wake up and recognize those people are being left there to die. This is day four.
All right.
My mother been helping people. She in this water. She stands 5 feet. The water was up to her breast.
Right.
And she coming through the water. People laugh.
All right, God damn it. Now, it can't be any more clear than this, what's going on. Like the sister said, this is a form of annihilation. This draining of people's life source is something we see going on in Haiti. These pictures easily could be Haitian pictures, or Rwandan pictures from the past, or Congo, or the Sudan. Is there some kind of connection? That some kind of commonality to those types of places and those types of people that I just named that's also taking place in New Orleans? Like the sister said, in Florida they had the flag set up, all the whole Red Cross type of stuff. They knew this thing was hitting. They didn't know if they were going to get a direct impact, but it was enough. They knew that the probability and the possibility was extremely high. Now you have a situation, as she said, seeing bodies float, and when the pigs and the soldiers were right off the boat treating people like prisoners. So one has to do for oneself. But my whole point is that we have to start getting prepared for these types of things beforehand, so that when these clowns come out and act a fool in an organized faction, we can serve them properly and have stuff set up for our own particular salvation. Because that's the last thing that these demonic savages, the last thing they have in mind.
much stronger, and that's because hurricanes take their energy from the temperature of surface waters. In the case of Katrina, it started as a Category 1, I think 70-mile-an-hour winds when it glanced off South Florida, but as it moved through the Gulf, where surface temperatures are about 80 degrees, it became enormously more powerful. I think the winds reached about 170 degrees, and that is a big reason for this incredible devastation that we've been seeing. It's very interesting that also Sir David King, who is Tony Blair's science advisor, made a direct link between hurricane intensity and global warming. And coincidentally, there was a piece of research done by Dr. Kerry Emanuel at MIT that came out just a couple of weeks ago that found that tropical storms had become 50% more severe in the last 30 years, again because of rising temperatures. We're seeing this increase in intensity all over the place. July was the second hottest July on record, and it triggered a record number of named tropical storms. So Hurricane Katrina fits right into the pattern here of what we're seeing. And just to stop for a second, if we look at some other events that have been happening the same year, not necessarily hurricanes, but we had a 2-foot snowfall in Los Angeles in January. We had 37 inches of rain in one day in Mumbai, India. We had this horrendous heat wave in 120 degrees in Arizona. We have the Missouri River just about empty because of a prolonged drought. All of these, including the intensity of hurricanes, are signatures of the warming of the planet. Science, in order to mitigate global warming, the science is very clear. We have to cut our emissions worldwide by 70%, and that threatens the survival of the coal and oil industry. We need a rapid global transition to clean energy. Unfortunately, the White House, under the Bush administration, has become the East Coast branch of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and those companies and those industries are really calling all the shots for climate and energy policy in this White House. So the regulations that you're talking about are very weak, and they're essentially being written by the lobbyists from big oil and big coal, and that's really what we're seeing in the Bush administration. This also is taking place against the background of a larger trend toward depletion of oil, and we're passing what's called peak oil globally, which means we're going to see a very rapid decline in oil supplies. So the emphasis maybe short-term on the increased price of gasoline, there should be right now a worldwide effort to move toward clean energy. And the United States stands in very stark contrast to what's happening in Europe. As I mentioned, the science says we need to cut emissions by 70%. Right now, Holland is cutting her emissions by 80% in 40 years. Tony Blair has committed Britain to cut emissions by 60% in 50 years. The Germans have committed to 50% cuts in 50 years. French President Chirac recently called on the entire industrial world to cut emissions by 75% by the year 2050.
First, there is the academic side of this voice, because I work at an historic with my college and university, and I've also worked as director of the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice, and we have been working with people for the last 15 years dealing with what we call environmental injustice. So I see it in two ways. As a person who was born and raised in New Orleans and loves the city very much, and on the other hand, looking at what the response has been, not only to the tragedy of Katrina, but what the response has been now for years to toxic exposure for people living in the Mississippi River Chemical Corridor. We have no emergency response for that. And so it's not surprising that the emergency response for this catastrophic situation seems to be non-existing. But what I really see happening is that people are not taking into consideration, and when I say people, I'm talking about the government, the pre-hurricane conditions of the city. And then we have to deal with what the post-hurricane conditions are, which are intrinsically tied to the pre-hurricane conditions. And then moving on to what we call the rebuilding stage. There are so many factors directly related to class and race. For those of us who live in New Orleans, it's mostly race, and class follows race. It's because of our race that our class is what it is. And people forget that New Orleans is 66 67% black. That's of the ones that are being counted. And more than 50% of that 67% live below poverty. This is mostly driven by the economic base of the city, which is tourism. That means low-paying jobs as waiters and dishwashers and cooks. And literally, I would say that there's been a huge resistance to raising the minimum wage that would raise the quality of life for most of the people in New Orleans. A second part of that is that the poverty in New Orleans, for the most part, has been hidden. Because the people in New Orleans have a very long history. They have been there since it was under control by the French and the Spanish. So the history is long. That's why the culture in New Orleans is just so enticing. And people want to come from all over the world for the music and the food. It has to do specifically with that history. But I am very concerned about what is happening since the hurricane. I don't need to go back into what we've been seeing on television. All of that is true. I have an uncle that is missing. My house is completely destroyed. The house of all of my friends, you know, houses are underwater. My friends are all over. They're in Houston. They're in Atlanta for the most part. But they're also in Birmingham and San Antonio and Jackson, Mississippi. So we are completely ripped apart. And what we are asking is why, in that we have been knowing that the levees needed to be shored up for a very, very long time. I mean, worst case scenarios have been presented at national meetings all over the world about what would happen to New Orleans. But yet, we have not gotten the kind of response, I would say pre-hurricane, from the White House that we should have gotten. I remember our legislators and our congresspeople fighting to get monies for our wetlands, fighting to get monies to shore up our levees. And so the Army Corps of Engineers needed another $208 million to finish the levee project, which they did not get. President Bush sent $10 million. And so now we're going to have to spend $26 billion on a project that could have cost us $208 million. And I hear people say, you know, well, people shouldn't live there. Well, people have been living here for more years than the United States has been in existence. And this is the first time we're having something this catastrophic. And this is after learning how to build dams and sending people to the moon. You know, so as a citizen of New Orleans, I am very angry, and I really, really believe that it's driven by race. People can say what they want, but when you look at who's left behind, it is very disturbing to me. Not to mention the fact of what's going to happen afterwards. Who will be involved in the rebuilding and the redesigning of New Orleans? Just before the hurricane, African-Americans, middle-class African-Americans, grassroots people were basically fighting for their life. We were fighting gentrification at a rate that we have never seen before. We were fighting the takeover of our public schools. We were fighting the dropping of the residency requirement. Hope 6 literally wiped out a housing project that had 7,000 African Americans, and they were displaced the same way that we have been displaced. Crime and violence was rampant because of the displacement of about 7,000 people, with poor people who had no place to go. Now we have to deal with the rebuilding. Who will be involved in the rebuilding of New Orleans, in the cleanup, you know, in the construction? And what I am experiencing, trying to find housing, the discrimination is rampant.
Only individuals with cause, with gear, can go and get out. So the only thing I've been doing all day is just making trips. Come and get, because you got to have the people with you. So I've been having at least one person from every family. And one of my friends who left gave me the keys to his van. And we have been taking people to get ice and water. And
That's what we've been doing, and having individuals just to help people when they get up to that, to the ferry, with ice and water. The sad part about it, I go to the, my next door neighbor is the public relations officer for the fire department. I go to the fire station looking for him, and I'm looking at water stacked up almost to the ceiling, and they wouldn't pass it out. I mean, you know, the different firemen were easier about them. But, I mean, but they wasn't passing it out. Now, I mean, last night, there was a big explosion. Most people thought that they was blowing up the levee. So from about 3 o'clock, when that explosion first happened, up until about dawn, you had people on pins and needles, worrying about whether or not they had blown, that they, you know, was the levee going to break. Because the only thing, New Orleans is like a bowl. And that bowl is floating on water. If you dig deep in New Orleans, you're going to hit water. I don't care where you at. You know, and people, I mean, people was literally terrified. You know, you have fires burning. You know, people are literally, I mean, scared. This the thing that started people, and they say it's looting. I say it's liberating. This is what started them to do it. Because I know right now, if my grandkids would have came here, and I ain't had nothing for them, I'd be damned if anybody would have told me that I couldn't go in no store and take what I wanted to make sure my kids had. You know what I mean? And it's sad when you see it. And then the governor and portraying everybody as a looter. But where was she? I bet you her kids wasn't without. You know? They're the ones that need to be shot. The mayor of New Orleans and the governor. They're the ones who need to be shot on site. Because them the ones who knew this was going to happen. And didn't do nothing. Nothing was in place. You know, when you see this, they're kind of... I'm not a person who advocates violence. I'm the founder, one of the founding members of the Green Party here in Louisiana. But when you see this kind of stuff going around, and then you hear her getting on TV, telling everybody to shoot to kill. What do you got to do to these vigilantes that's out here? You know, I mean, you have individuals that are scared to walk through predominantly white neighborhood. That's, I mean, literally scared, terrified to walk down Fraser Street. Individuals telling them how to take the long way around. Why? Because nobody wants to see anybody get shot. You have had many individuals, like the person I was telling you, Henry Alexander and others, that have literally stopped individuals from taking up guns and saying, well, hey, we're going to meet them. And nobody was around. You got the police doing 5 or 6 different things. And when you go over there and you ask them, do they want volunteers? Oh, no, we don't want no volunteers. What can we do? Oh, you go home. Pack your stuff and leave. It's like that's what they're trying to do. Make the conditions so bad, so untenable that you're forced to leave. Because they knew, Bush, all of them knew this was going to happen. I mean, it didn't take all that for the rock. When they went there, what they done? They went to Kuwait. And they just literally had everything in place until he gave the order to go in there and slaughter
Rocky. Why couldn't he have everything in place to come in here and help his own people? Why we had to wait a week? Well, I mean, you're not bringing people all the way, no, 7,000 miles. You know, you got three military bases right here in the Algiers. You got the port of embarkation, you got the Navy base, and you got the Navy Air Base here. Why did it take so long? That's what I wanted to ask. Why did so many people have to die before you could roll up your sleeve and do something? So many people that could have been saved. You know, why we have to sit around and they have to tell your kids not to go to certain places because there's nothing but dead bodies? Because I bet you ain't seen them picking up on none of them.
Valued black life. They're the looters. People dying in their little concentration camp convention centers. The raggedy head of FEMA and the Homeland Department didn't even know. They run out of food in the Astrodome. They run out of towels there on Thursday night. Not no damn accident. If some professional gladiators had been playing there, they wouldn't have ran out of nothing. This is what's going on intentionally. This is the real world. It's time we put a death sentence on them. Their order. Their systems. Those who are administrators for their system. And those who are part of the machine.